K2RIW here. We begin the TechNet. At this time, the main purpose of the TechNet is education. The curious radio amateurs gather at this time, share their information about what they know and have found out about wireless equipment, ham radio equipment in particular, but also other kinds of scientific equipment. The person signs into the TechNet by giving us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment for the net. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name. K2RIW to be listening.
This is Kilo Charlie 2, Fox Yankee Yankee, KC2FYY, William Yes.
And WS2N, your audio is usually a little bit louder, I think, Dick.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I'm trying to find out what's going on here. Let me do a test. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, well. We'll eventually find out what's going on. William, we've got you. And WS2N, we heard from you. Anyone else to check into the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name right now.
N2EO, Dick, with a question.
Okay, we got Rich, N2EO. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW.
KD2RMD, Russell.
Okay, Russell, is that Kilo Delta 2 Romeo Mike Delta? Over to you, Russell.
Yes, no, that is correct, and no question, no info for the net. I'll be monitoring on the side, but I will also be at a outside meeting.
Yeah, N2 Mike Bravo, South Carolina, just saying hi.
Hi, Barry. Haven't heard from you in a long time. Too bad you don't have a question for us also. One last call. Anyone else to have a question or a comment for the net, please give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW. Okay, we're going to start off with William first. KC2, Fox Yankee Yankee. You've got it, William.
Okay, appreciate that. Just to follow up on a previous encounter here, when I was talking about a folded monopole, and I did some cutting, and I finally was able to tune the antenna the way I wanted, and those results are now on repeater builder under a PD-128, which is the name of the antenna. And so others who, like WA2RYY, assisted me, and so I appreciate that. The topic tonight is a folded dipole antenna. It's a decibel DB-404 for UHF, and I want to cut it for a frequency down around 441 megahertz. I'm getting a vector network analyzer, something I purchased, and it looks like I'm going to have to re-bend the elements or the folded dipoles. Let me drop it a second. So just to give a description of the antenna, there are four folded dipoles, and they're all harnessed together. So my thought is I should experiment by taking one of them off, creating maybe a piece of coax that is phased for that particular one, and then doing some additional bending. This is aluminum tubing. Very small, so it should be something doable. Any suggestions on, I saw online there was a calculator that you could plug in some information to get some results, but how would you go about the process of bending these new dipoles for this antenna?
Okay, there's quite a bit of missing information here, William. The four dipoles, are they vertically stacked as a base station-like antenna? So they might be vertically stacked, you know, two of them horizontal east-west and two of them horizontal north-south or something like that. That's question number one. Question number two, when you sweep that antenna, at what frequency does it give you the best standing wave ratio? In other words, how far do you have to move it? Does it peak right now at 435 and you want it on 442, so to speak? And how bad is the standing wave ratio at either of those frequencies? So give us that information first, William. KC2FYY, K2RIW.
Okay, so yes, they are stacked, two for east and then the other two for west, and you can rotate those. And the best SWR is up at 473. I obviously want it to be down near 441. I don't know what it is at 441 off the top of my head, but to me it's totally unacceptable. So I want to try to, obviously I'm going to have to make them longer, so rebuild one and get one the correct size and then duplicate that for the other three and attach those together. I don't know if there'll be any problems with the existing phasing harness, which is a commercial product that's on there already. But I don't know how far off in frequency I could deviate without having to rebuild the harness. So that throws in another question, I guess. KC2FYY.
Was the antenna originally designed for the 471 frequency region, and now you're trying to move it down to 441, 473? Was that what it's originally designed for, or was it designed to be a 441 and it's just what you've measured? Over to you, William.
It's originally designed to be in the commercial sector band, so bringing it down to, say, 450 is when you start to see the curve really increase in terms of the SWR going out of control. So it's not like I can bring it from 450 to, like, 448 or something very easily. I think I'm going to have to totally rework it.
Now, to bring it down in frequency, you'd like to be able to make the dipoles longer, but that's mechanically not easy to do. However, electronically, you can bring the dipoles down by putting tabs of copper tape on the tips of each of the dipoles. You may, it sounds like a gimmicky way to do things, but in reality, it's got a very high performance capability. So if you took chunks of copper tape, or maybe 1 or 2 square inches, so to speak, and tape it to the tips of the four dipoles, and then experiment with how much copper tape. You can tune the copper tape by bending it. In other words, make a copper tape a tab that's a little bit longer than required, and with a long wooden stick, you can bend them over. So chunks of copper tape on the tips of the dipole will bring it down in frequency very fast. Most balloning structures that's feeding the four dipoles, the balloning structure itself is usually very broadband. It may not require any modifications. So that's the first experiment I would do. And you can also get a hint as to how much more copper tape is required by making yourself a tuning tool. Start off with a long wooden stick with a chunk of copper tape on the end of it, and holding that wooden stick with the copper tape near the tips of the dipoles while watching the performance on an antenna analyzer or a bird watt meter looking at reflective power, any of the ways that you can monitor reflective power, which really is the magnitude of your standing wave ratio. So you may get an awful lot of performance out of that. And then as long as you're treating each of the four dipoles the same way, you don't have to go down to an individual dipole. To go down to an individual dipole, I'm not recommending that you do that at first, William, because to assume that each individual dipole is exactly a 50 or 70 ohm load may not be true. Depending on how the design of that impedance matching, the power divider was made, the individual dipoles, you're not quite sure how they were designed for what impedance. So I wouldn't recommend that approach. I'm not saying it won't work. I'm just saying it's a long, as a dark horse. But the chunks of copper tape, you may find that are very successful. And while you've got that tuning tool in your hands, after you arrive at what you think is the right size for the tabs of copper tape on the tips of the dipole, and you can no longer get any further improvement by bending or holding the tuning tool near them, you can also hold the tuning tool near the center of each of the dipoles, because a gimmicking copper tape there might do something very desirable as far as impedance matching is concerned. So a lot of these gimmick tuning techniques can give you an awful lot of performance, and even though they look a little bit hokey, because you're putting the copper tapes at a point at the dipole where the voltage is high and the current is very low, it can be very high in performance. It doesn't waste any power, if you know what I mean. KC2RYY, K2RYY, FYY, K2RYW, go ahead, William.
All right, yes, I know that particular method. I was thinking of taking a piece of aluminum, since it is aluminum, a strip of aluminum, and I could do it that way too. And I good suggestion on the way the phasing harness is made. I am willing to, mechanically, I have no problem, build out of new aluminum tubing these loops. So the thought is, and I heard your suggestion, the thought is if I remove just one folded dipole, I know what frequency that has, you could say, has kind of been cut for, because I know, you know, from the previous analysis, and then if I measure that individual dipole, and if it gives me a different type of SWR, then I know something is going on in the phasing harness, and the phasing harness is not going to, you know, be... It has some relationship instead of being the same resonant frequency that I originally checked when they were all on. It's kind of my thought process. It wouldn't be too difficult to do, just remove one and test that individually by itself. Are those thoughts correct, Casey, to FYY?
If you really know the impedance that the phasing harness assumes that each of the dipoles has a particular impedance, 50 ohms maybe, 70 ohms maybe something different. So that you don't know, and if you assumed it's 50 and it's really 70, that will give you a different impedance match, a different standing wave ratio, best frequency, if you know what I mean. So that could fool you a little bit. Also, because the original dipoles are made out of aluminum, and yes, you could reform new aluminum tubing at a slightly longer length to reform those dipoles, but that's an awful lot of work. Putting on pieces of copper tape near the rounded tips of the individual folded dipoles could very easily bring you down in frequency so fast and so effectively, you wouldn't have to remanufacture those. And don't worry about dissimilar metals in this case. Ordinarily, copper and aluminum coming in contact with each other make a rather poor contact. In the case of putting slabs of copper tape on the tips of the aluminum tubing, folded dipoles, because the impedance is so high out there, it's mostly capacitive coupling between the interface of the aluminum tubing and the copper tape. Even though the glue and the copper tape may not be a perfect conductor, it doesn't matter. The capacitive coupling out there where the impedance is so high at the tips will do all the electrical connection you need. So before remanufacturing those aluminum tubings, I would do the copper tape test first. And maybe you've got aluminum tape, but copper tape is the usual way that people do this. And you may get a very fast solution that way, William. KC2FYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I will try that at first, and then ultimately, I guess what I'm trying to find is to obviously help myself and make it public for everybody else. If I did actually re-bend them and I knew what they were, I could distribute those dimensions, because I'm sure people are using this particular antenna all over the place for UHF repeaters, but I haven't come across, somebody who has shown how they've reworked it or retuned it down. But all right, I'll let you know the results after I do some of that experimentation. Just another question. if I did put the copper tape on and extended the length, say, would that have any relationship if I was going to rebuild the new length, or it'd be totally different?
That's not an easy one to answer, because the amount of capacitance you're adding with a tab of copper tape and the amount of extra tuning you're making by making the aluminum tubing longer, they're going to be close. In other words, if you extended the length by an inch with the copper tape and you extended the length by an inch with the aluminum tubing, the results would be close, but not exactly the same. But you may be afraid to publish the results with the copper tape. The way you affix the copper tape, the way you fold it over, and you could make a long enough piece of copper tape that is folded in the middle, and half of the glue is sitting on the forward face of the dipole, and the other half is sitting on the back face. There's ways you can make that very robust and reasonably easy with the dimensions given for other people to do it for themselves, as opposed to the remanufacture of the aluminum tubing. The remanufacturing of aluminum tubing is quite a bit more elaborate. For you, it may be easy. For some people, that's difficult. But adding the chunks of copper tape on the tips is something that most people can do if given the proper instructions. And by way of the copper tape on the tips, and maybe some copper tape coming close to shorting the two rods together near the base of the dipole, and you can find that out by holding your tuning tool with the copper tape near the end of it in that vicinity while watching the standing wave ratio. But by these gimmicking techniques, I guarantee you're going to get a very good impedance match if you're willing to spend the time. And once you start doing it, you'd be amazed how easy it is to do, William. KC2FYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, yeah, I will try that first for sure. I appreciate it. Thank you for the advice as usual. And that concludes the questions for this evening. So you'll hear back from me when I figure out all of the solutions. Thanks again. KC2FYY.
Very fine, William. And looking forward to hearing what you discover and how well it worked. Next person on the list was Rich N2EO. N2EO, go ahead, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I'll say hello to everybody. First, if Barry is listening, I use my handheld in bed when I lay down, and I don't get into W2VL well, very poorly. The 440 line mark, I get into fine. So, I don't know where you have an echo link on that repeater, which is W2KPQ. If there is, maybe Barry can find it. I had trouble finding it. Why not if we can connect on 440 line mark? Was it 9125? And we'll go from there. With get a good connection, I can use the radio when Barry can be on echoing. Anyway, my question, Dick, compared to William, I think that was his name. It's simple. Stupid question. Hold on. Okay, I have this MFJ1263. It's a very nice unit. It allows me to use any mic brand on any radio by setting up jumpers. You know, these little plastic black jumpers you put over the pins. You set them up, whatever mic you're going to use, and for what the two sets, one, whichever radio you're going to use. For instance, right now I'm on an Icon, and I'm using a Kenwood mic, and it works perfectly on the Kenwood HF and on the Icon what I'm on now. So I only need one mic, not two. Hold on. Anyway, there's a little problem. They put a switch, says speaker, on, off. And there's a volume control. It's like an auxiliary volume for the receive audio. You have to take your jumper, put it into in on the back. On the back, you put the speaker into out. Everything should be fine. So I can turn the speaker on and off. Whatever reason, the volume control does not work, has no effect. I can't find the schematic, and I think I'm going to have to lift the board and see. Maybe one side of the pot was not soldered properly. Maybe the ground side. What do you think, Jake? M2EO.
Yeah, that's a tough one, Rich. I guess you've already searched the internet. Quite often there are schematics for rigs. I guess the owner's manual doesn't include a schematic for your MFJ 1263. Is that true, Rich? So you've searched the internet for a schematic, and you've searched your owner's manual. Is that true, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, they don't give you an owner's manual on anything anymore. It's on the internet, which is not a problem for me because my eyes are bad. And I see on the internet with brightness much clearer than written print. No, I haven't been able to find a schematic. There is a website that says MFJ 1263 schematic. What it shows you is a screenshot of the board. That's no help. Back to you, Dick.
And the screenshot of the printed circuit board, they call that the schematic. Wow. Now, there's a slim possibility that it's a kind of a screenshot where if it's a double-sided board, by way of dim and bright wiring, you can see the wiring of the board as if you had X-ray vision. So is it just a pure photograph, and do you think it's a single-sided PC board? So what does that screenshot look like, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Now, it's a single board, a single-sided board. By the way, they're using good components now, not like years ago. It's a G10 glass board. Everything is very neat and marked. And everything is solder masked. I think the way it looks, I'm going to have to lift the board because the volume control is soldered to the underside of the board. I'm going to see if I can get in there. It's very hard to get to the connections on the pot from the top. But I do want to try and take an ohmmeter reading. What do you think? The ground side, the hot side. It's not going to be the wiper. It's brand new pot. It was just an error. You know, that happens.
Now, you and I are sitting here assuming that the pot is really in the circuit. And maybe there's a jumper that you have to set just right to get that pot in the circuit. Also, the rig itself, there's a volume control on the rig. Does that affect what audio comes out of this auxiliary speaker on your microphone setup? That might be a way of controlling it. And by the way, is your problem that the volume is too large and you want to cut it down with that volume control pot? Over to you for those questions, Rich. K2RIW.
Well, it's just a convenience. I'm a purist, you know that. And I like to work, I don't like sending anything back. My pride. I have a lot of good tools here, mostly Exolite. Top of the line, everything. I recently purchased it with over $300 worth of tools. It's good to work with good tools, not junk like Radio Shack tools. No, but everything works fine. I can turn the speaker on and off. The volume is fine. Goes up and down on the radio. Everything is perfect, except that pot has no effect. I like everything to work. That's why I'm going to go with it. Like I said, I'm a purist. Whatever.
If the photograph of the pendant circuit board is high enough in resolution, you could make yourself your own schematic diagram. In other words, by tracing where the lands go and how they make contact to the potentiometer, you may be able to generate your own schematic from that photograph, Rich. Is that out of the question? N2EO, K2LAW?
Yes, it is, Dick. They don't show you what they call a schematic. They give you a screenshot on this website. It only shows the left side of the board where the jumpers are to set whichever mic you're going to use, whichever radio. The pot is the last thing on the right side. You can't shift it on the screen. It's very poor. Not there.
If this is a single-sided G10 printed circuit board, are the components and the lands on the same side of the board? Is that being shown in the photograph, Rich? Go ahead.
No, I have the thing open. I have it open to set the jumpers. I'm very familiar with it. Everything is on the underside of the board. Only two electrolytic capacitors on the top and the solder on the bottom. That's the way it looks. Everything else is on the bottom. Single-sided board.
Now, the potentiometer in question, is it connected to the case and there's wires going from it to the PC board? Or does the potentiometer get mounted directly on that PC board? Rich, go ahead.
Okay, well, it's mounted on the PC board underside. There's nothing to see on the top. The legs of the pot go down. You can hardly see them on the top. And they bend over, I think, and solder on the underside. That's why I think I got to lift the board.
Hey, to AMZ.
Mr. AMZ, start off with your name and then your information. Go right ahead.
K2MZ, Mike, if Rich is talking about the MFJ 1263, could you confirm that, please?
That's a big 10-4, 1263, Mike, go ahead.
Okay, you go to the MFJ website, you download their PDF, and there's your schematic. I'm looking at it right now.
He's complaining that there isn't enough resolution on the right-hand side of the PC board. Left side where all the jumpers are, lots of resolution. But he can't figure out the schematic of the right-hand side, which includes the potentiometer. He's having trouble making the potentiometer work. Back to you, Mike.
Listen, I'm looking at the schematic right now. It's a PDF. All you got to do is zoom in on it, and you can see anything you want. I'm looking at it right now. There's your schematic. There's your, it's a, I guess I don't have my glasses on, but it's like, it's all right there. I don't understand what Rich's problem is. You go to the PDF, everything you want to see is right there. 2GS?
Okay, go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, as Mike said, it's page 21 of the PDF. It's all the way on the right-hand side. His computer might be cutting it off because of something strange about his computer. You see the schematic, you see the phone jack, you see the speaker switch, you see the potentiometer, you see a small resistor feeding into the middle of the potentiometer. It's all there. It's just that he can't get the screen probably off to the far right side.
Dick?
Go ahead, Rich.
Well, thank you, mind you. I'm working in the wrong place. I did go to the MFJ website. I must have missed it. Because I'm looking at something entirely different. Another website. That's what I'm talking about. So right now, when we finish up, I'm going to go to the MFJ website and download that PDF file. Thank you, fellas. Over to you, Dick.
82MZ for another quick follow-up. All you got to do is Google MFJ 1263 PDF, and bingo will take you right there. You don't have to go looking at it very far. Use Google. It'll take you 5 seconds to find it there, Rich.
And Mike, did you say it's Page 23 is the schematic, or the physical photograph of board. Did you say it was page 23, Mike?
Negative. Page 21 is the schematic. Page 21 is the full-blown schematic. Everything you want to know.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. I was looking in the wrong place. I'm going to go on Google, look up MFJ 1263 PDF, correct?
Yeah. You punch that into Google, and you're going to go down a couple of entries, and it's going to bring you to their manual. It's going to bring you to the product page. Then you click on, it's right there, Rich. It should take you all of 2 seconds to find KD2AMZ.
Bravo Zulu. Bravo Zulu, go ahead, Rich.
It's beyond that. You can Google the exact problem you're having. If you're, this happened when I was in tech support with computers. If one person's having a problem with something about their computer, you can darn well bet that a lot of people are having the problem. So beyond just trying to solve it yourself, Google the problem. Put it in a sentence. Doesn't have to be an exact sentence. And Google the problem. You'll get tons of people having the same problem.
In his case, the potentiometer is not functioning. So I guess you're saying if he says MFJ 1263, non-functioning potentiometer, he might get the answer. Is that what you're saying, Bravo Zulu?
Absolutely. Or, if he doesn't get it like that, mentioning the potentiometer, he can just Google his model number and problem. You start off as specific as you can, and then you go more general and more general and more general, and I guarantee you somebody's had this problem, or hundreds of people have had this problem.
82 AMZ also with another comment. The circuit is really nothing. It's a potentiometer. It looks like a 50K. I don't have my glasses on. Looks like a quick voltage divider. Goes to your phone. And then it goes to a jack J2. And I think it's the other one, J1, J2. It's really a nothing circuit there. It's all passive components. It's just that basically it's an in and out, nothing particularly complex, and give MFJ a call. They'll help you out. They got people there who actually will help you out tomorrow. Just call them during business hours.
Mike, from what you can tell by what you're studying, the potentiometer goes to J2, which may not be the internal speaker that he's talking about. The internal speaker is the one that he's not able to control the volume of. Is it wired to the internal speaker, or would you, Mike, wait for the beeps?
There is no internal speaker in the MFJ 1263 because I have one. I've been using it for the longest. There is no internal speaker. If you want to wire a speaker to it, you got to plug it into the back. Actually, this volume control is for headphones if you want to plug them in. That's what the potentiometer is for. There is no internal speaker.
Okay, you just said a couple of magic words. The fact that it's a 50K potentiometer tells me it is not intended to go to a loudspeaker. A loudspeaker is more like 8 ohms. And if you had a potentiometer for that, it would be something close to a 16-ohm potentiometer. It certainly wouldn't be 50K. You can't feed a 16-ohm loudspeaker with a 50K potentiometer. So I'm being led to believe that that potentiometer is only intended for earphone service, not for loudspeaker volume control service. Does everyone think that that's a possibility? K2RAW in the TechNet?
AC2GS?
Go ahead.
And KD2AMZ, this is only for headphones, period. No speaker.
You got it, Roy. Thank you, Mike. I mean, Rich, you got it, Roy.
Yes, thank you, Dick. It's a 500 ohm potentiometer. The way it looks, and I have one too. It has a speaker input, it has a speaker output, and it has a phone's output. So I guess the idea is you plug in the speaker from your radio to the speaker input, then you can run an actual speaker to the output and switch it in and out, or you can use it to feed the phone connection, and it's a 500 ohm potentiometer, not 50K.
Katie, I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see it. But yeah, that's exactly the way it works.
Mike, does your potentiometer work with a speaker? Maybe there's something wrong.
Negative, Rich. This is not meant for a speaker. This potentiometer is meant for headphones, period. That's it. No external speaker is to be wired. Well, it can be wired, but it's not going to work with this thing. This is strictly for headphones, period.
Roy, is that the way you see it, Roy? Because you seem to see it another way. AC2GS, K2IW.
I agree with Mike. If you look at the schematic, and that's something that Richie should take a look at when he has a chance, it's the phone that is hooked up to the potentiometer source. So that's what's going on when you're twiddling with the volume knob. It's adjusting the volume of the phone output signal, not the speaker output signal. That's probably why he's having that problem.
N2A, N2EO. Go ahead, Rich, for any further comments.
Well, God bless both of you, because I would have taken the board apart, lifted it when there's no problem. So thank you. See, it just says speaker off, speaker on, and volume. It does not say headphone volume. That's where the confusion is.
Sounds like you're a lot smarter now, Rich, than you were before.
Yes, Dick. As usual, problem solved here.
Okay. Do we have anyone else with that wants their call letters and name put on the list? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2IW in the tech net.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, Rich.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Are they imperative to use? How do you know when to use them? And how helpful can they be, and in what ways?
Okay, you dropped out right when you said the key word. So repeat the whole last message, Rich. Go ahead. And speak softly because you dropped out of the machine.
Okay, common mode chokes. I'm wondering, how do you know if you need one? Do you always need one? Do they always improve something? And what exactly do they improve? And how do you know that you really should think about putting one in the circuit?
Are you now talking about a feed line to antenna interface and putting a common mode choke at that junction? I mean, the word common mode choke, it could be used on a printed circuit board for an audio circuit, or it could be used on an antenna circuit between the feed line and the antenna. So you didn't tell us which application you're discussing, Rich. Go ahead.
I didn't even realize there were multitude of applications. This is in line with the coax at the rig.
Rarely do you put a common mode choke at the rig. You would do it at the antenna. If I was feeding my coax cable directly to the center of a dipole, center conductor goes to the right side and the shield goes to the left side of the dipole. Because of the way a dipole works, Mother Nature wants that to be a balanced circuit. In other words, if you're putting 100 volts on the dipole, on the first half cycle, Mother Nature wants the right-hand side to be plus 50, and the left-hand side to be minus 50 during that half cycle. She forces a balance, and the voltages are reversed on the second half of the cycle. As such, you're now putting RF energy being fed back from the dipole directly onto the shield of the coax cable. Therefore, the shield of the cable in that experience will be hot. That's not a showstopper, but it's less than an ideal way of feeding a dipole. And now the outer conductor of the shield of your coax transmission line becomes half of your dipole, becomes part of the radiating system. It pulls it to another frequency, it adjusts the standing wave ratio, you might have RF in the shack and so on. So by putting an RF choke, either by way of a
a floating balloon-like structure right at the dipole, or by making one of the choking assemblies right at the dipole, you can correct that problem. Let me drop for a second. There's a zillion ways you can make a choke at that point. A quarter wavelength bazooka balloon is one of them. A half-wave coax hybrid adapter, a 4-to-1 impedance match with a half-wave chunk of coax if you've got a 200-ohm impedance antenna. The most simple way that works very effectively is a few turns of coax mounted right at the feed point of the dipole. By way of the formula that's in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where the chapter tells you how do you estimate the amount of inductance of a inductor? How do you adjust? How do you estimate how many microhenry it has, or millihenry, or whatever? There's a formula there where you plug in the number of turns, the diameter of the turns, and it will tell you inductance. Because of the frequency you're operating at, you know how to calculate inductive reactance. Inductive reactance is 2 pi FL. In other words, inductive reactance in ohms is 2 pi times the frequency in hertz and the inductance in henry. You take your inductor, once you know it's microhenries, millihenries, or whatever, with the right exponents or the right decimal places, you enter that formula and you find out what is the inductive reactance. If, for instance, you were doing the formula at 10 meters, you're feeding a 10-meter dipole, you know your frequency is going to be something like 28 megacycles. You plug that in. By way of the number of turns you have selected on your coax cable, you know how much inductance it has. If you can make the inductance of the turns something high compared to 50 ohms, you got a 50-ohm coax. If you could make it 500 or 5,000 ohms of inductive reactance, that's so close to an open circuit that choke, that poor man's balloon by way of multiple turns right at the dipole taped together will now act as a high impedance reactance, which is close to an open circuit, and therefore the RF energy flowing down the outside of the coax will not go beyond that point. It will not go down the rest of the transmission line and not into the shack. Is that picture starting to make some sense to you, Rich? W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RAW in the TechNet.
That makes perfect sense. I was wondering, how do you know you need one? How can you tell? I could understand RF in the shack, that I know. Let's say it's not an RF in the shack problem. How do you know, if you need one, and how do you know that it has improved things?
If I'm about to connect transmission line directly to a dipole, center conductor to the right side and the shield to the left side of the dipole, I know I have the problem. I don't have to make a measurement. I know I am violating one of the laws of how you feed a dipole. It's not a showstopper, but it's a less than ideal way of feeding a dipole. In a pinch, you can do it, but it's not recommended. You're going to have a hot cable every time you do that. And the hot cable is now changing the tuning of the dipole, the center frequency, the impedance match, and so on. And it's that scenario where people change the length of the feed line and they see a change in the standing wave ratio of the dipole, and they say, aha, the length of the transmission line creates an impedance match. Not true, but they think it does. You're just changing how many wavelengths of dipole, of feed line you've got. By the way, the Doctor is In section of the latest issue of QSD magazine has an article on this exact subject. So if you're making that direct connection, you know you need a choke or a ballooning structure. If you're feeding the center of a folded dipole on a Yagi, again, you know that you don't want to connect the transmission line directly to that without some kind of a choking assembly or a ballooning assembly. So in those cases, by physical arrangement of what you're about to do, let me drop it. You know that you need one. If you want to be an exact scientist, by way of the latest issue of QST magazine, by way of the Doctor is In section, he gives you a schematic of how you can measure how much current is flowing on the outside of the transmission line, if that's what you want to know. But that's academic. To be double darn sure, belt and suspenders, whenever you're feeding transmission line directly to a dipole or any kind of a balanced antenna, you know you need one if you want it to be a pure feeding situation. Even if you don't really need one, and if you have a few extra turns of the transmission line taped together right at the feed point of the dipole, as I said, it's belt and suspenders. You know that you've solved the problem even before you find out whether or not you've got one. So that's one possible philosophical approach to the problem, Rich. W2BZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
RWW2BZ in the net. Once again, how do you know it's helped? I mean, will it affect FWR dramatically or enough to say, wow, that's pretty cool? Or just how do you know? Let me put it another way. It sounds like best practices should be putting up a dipole always at the feed point, always. Put some kind of common mode one-to-one choke there. I guess that's what you're saying, but what should somebody notice before and after?
If you connect your transmission line directly to the dipole without some kind of a balloning or choking structure, 98% of the time you're going to measure standing wave ratio of that dipole in different than what you expect. Because now the transmission line is hot, it's part of the radiating system, it's changing the impedance and the tuning of that dipole. There's a rare case in which that won't do that. If you happen to have an exact number of multiples of a half wavelength of transmission line back to the transmitter in the shack, and the transmitter in the shack is directly grounded. And I said that backwards. I said, odd number. If you have an odd number of quarter wavelengths of length of transmission line, and the shack end is directly grounded, that's the one case where the resonance of that length of transmission line will create an open circuit for the outer shield right of the dipole. Only at that magic length, an odd number of quarter wavelengths of transmission line. Anything other than that, you're going to be getting some loading and reactants and whatever of the way you're feeding the transmission line, some RF energy being fed back. So if you want to be a scientist, you connect the transmission line directly, you make a standing wave ratio measurement. You then install the choke, and you make the measurement again. And in most cases, you're going to see a change telling you that your transmission line is no longer hot. Another way you can find out that it's hot is that when you connect the transmission line directly without a choke, and you run your hand along the transmission line outer shield, the outer plastic, you run your hand along the transmission line while watching the standing wave ratio, you will see the standing wave ratio going up and down if the transmission line is hot. And once you add the choke, that effect will disappear. W2BZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so I'm assuming, I think it's a pretty good assumption, that long wires do not have this problem in any way. Is that correct?
Okay. There's a zillion ways you can feed a long wire. So there is no yes or no answer to that. It depends. Many people feed a long wire by way of open, 400 ohm or 600 ohm open wire line. And what they do with the unused piece of the open wire line is not clear. There's a zillion ways of feeding an end-fed ZEP antenna, like a long wire. So, and how long is the wire and how high is the impedance? In many cases, the long wire is a non-resonant length, in which case it's got an extremely high impedance. Very little current is needed to launch a signal onto it, and there you can get away with some murder. But can you say it's not required in a long wire line? You can't say that. There's a zillion ways of feeding it, and there's a zillion different lengths a long wire is going to have, and the spacing above the ground. There's too many variables in that situation there, Rich. W2BZ, K2RIW.
That I don't understand, because we're talking about a two-shield being a wire, a two-wire system in the first example that you've been talking about. Now to a one-wire system, it seems like because that second wire or the shield is not present, that the problem is not present. So what am I missing there?
You didn't tell me how you're feeding the long wire. If the long wire comes all the way back to the semiconductor of the output connector of your transmitter, that's one way of feeding a long wire. That's what you seem to be describing. I assumed you had some kind of transmission line going from the transmitter up to the antenna, to the beginning of the antenna, and the antenna itself is a long wire. I had an entirely different mental image from your mental image, which you did not tell me. What would you, Rich? W2BZ, K2RIW?
Hey, well, whether it be a 4-to-1 or a 9-to-1 or a 49-to-1, I'm experimenting with a 9-to-1. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, again, you didn't give me a lot of information. Is there a 50-ohm transmission line coming out of the transmitter going up to your 9-to-1 balun, which is mounted at the beginning of your long wire? Is that what you're describing? There's a lot of missing information you didn't tell us. It's clear in your head, the picture you've got, you didn't tell us what's in your head. Over to you, Rich.
Little in my head. No, it's the 9-to-1 is at the rig.
Okay, therefore you're bringing the long wire all the way back to the rig. Is that what you're saying?
The way right into the 9-to-1 and put a coax from the 9-to-1 into the back of the rig.
Okay, now I've got the picture of what kind of different ways of feeding a long wire. You now described any way of doing it. And now what's your question about that? Is it the right way to do it? Well, it depends on what's the any wave ratio you get and how well it's working. Is it working for you? Is that what you want to know, Rich? Go ahead.
In that configuration, what I want to know is will a 1-to-1 RF choke help me? Should I definitely try it?
If you add a 1-to-1 choke as well as the balance, it's now belt and suspenders. However, your 9-to-1 has two output connectors, and with your long wire, you're only using one of them. You haven't told us what you're doing with the other output connector. And on top of that, what frequency you're feeding it and how long is the long wire will make huge differences in what measurements you make, what visual you'll get, how well it works, and so on. So there's a lot of variables involved here. Just choosing a piece of wire and saying, you're a long wire, and I intend to use you on 80 through 10 meters by feeding it with a 9-to-1 balun. You can say that and you can try it, but I guarantee some of those bands, you're not going to be happy with the results. Over to you, Rich.
I'm trying this mostly on 80 and 40 as they are the quote-unquote the bands in today's world of propagation, and 20 also, but 20 is fairly dead. What I have is I'm doing it with a BNR right now, but is the output of the 9-to-1 going into a tuner, the tuner going into the rig, and the other output, the other wire is going into a 9-foot ground rod, and the other two wires are connected together the way they show in just about every video on making one of these. So it's coming into the rig from the output of the 9-to-1, and the other wire is the ground wire.
M2EO, Dick, I have some comments.
Yeah, with that grounding rod, you've got a pretty clean way of feeding your long wire. What performance are you getting, visual-wise, on 80 and 40 meters where you care the most? Over to you on that one, Rich.
That's a whole, as Roy knows, that's another keg of worms. But there is a, for both 80 and 40 and 20, with this MFJ tuner, there is a, let's say, the numbers of the tuner, of the inductor, the roller inductor, in the little counter go from 1 to 100. There is one spot that is, let's say, just for argument's sake, between 8 and 9, that if you don't hit it right in the middle at 8.5, you're going to have an SWR all over the place. But if you hit it right where it's supposed to be, and they only spot in this whole travel of the roller inductor, if you hit it right there, I'm getting down to about a 2-to-1 on both bands, and it's a 66-foot length of wire.
That magic spot on the roller inductor, is that the exact same magic spot for both 80 and 40 meters, Rich, or is it two different slightly related spots?
Completely different spots, but the exact same performance. In other words, if you blink a second, you're going to go past that point that the tuner is making the rig happy, or now I have a happy rig. It's unbelievable. It's so narrow on the tuner.
Yeah, that's pretty strong evidence that you've got a very high standing wave ratio with that 9-to-1 balance and your grounding rod into that 66-foot long wire. You've got some pretty high standing wave ratio. In fact, a 66-foot long piece of wire is very close to a quarter wavelength on 80 meters and a half wavelength on 40. Let's just talk about 40. You feed the outer tip of a half wavelength dipole on 40, where there's no insulator in the center. You're feeding an impedance of around 2,000 ohms. So your 9-to-1 balun with its wire going to a grounding rod is a pretty high Q circuit. Because it's such a high Q circuit, that's why there's such critical tuning of that antenna tuner. And so there's no easy solution to that one. You're running into one of the problems of a long wire antenna, that at certain length of the long wire, you're going to get very critical tuning. Let's see what Rich has got to say on this. Maybe he's used a long wire. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. You never, Mama, we discussed this, Dick. You never feed or use coax unless the SWR is inherently low. If you're getting high SWR on coax, it becomes very, very, very lossy. Coax cable, I found, is only low loss when it's terminated in a 50-ohm load or a 75-ohm load. More than that, you don't use coax. And he's feeding that end-fed the wrong way. What you do is called an end-fed zip. They use them for years on the lighter than aircraft, Zeppelins. What you do, let me let it drop. You put a wire up with an insulator at the end. One side of the ladder line goes to the wire. The other side goes to the other side of the insulator, which maybe is tied off with some non-conductive material. Sounds crazy, but the reason it works is because that other wire that's not terminated acts as a counterpoise for the antenna. That's what magic is. You don't connect to anything and it works. You don't use the ground rod. You bring the ladder line into the ham shack, use a 4-to-1 balun. I can tell you a good company is a company called Balun Designs. It's a very good company. He's small. He works from home. He's in Texas. From the other side of the balun, I have 50-ohm coax, a short jumper over to the coax in output of the antenna tuner. And that works fine. It'll work on center fed, end fed, zip, anything, Dick.
Yeah, what you're saying, Rich, is true for you, but you're describing a very different situation. In your case, when you had a high standing wave ratio on 50-ohm transmission line, where there was a long length of transmission line from the shack to the antenna, with high standing wave ratio, you end up with a lot of loss. His transmission line is only a couple of feet long, going between the balun in the shack and the antenna in the shack, and the small length of transmission line going into the transmitter. So in his case, loss of the 50-ohm transmission line is not a factor. He's not using open wire line, which you used. He's feeding his 9-to-1 Balun directly into the open wire antenna, which comes into the shack. So he's got a very, very different situation. You described one of the ways that people have effectively fed